This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This cannot go on forever, that's for sure.
In our quest to make a better world, we often strive for more efficient use of resources. But is the goal of efficiency the right one? Our guest this week on Sea Change Radio, Low Tech Magazine founder Chris Dedecker, makes a compelling case for the abandonment of efficiency as the barometer for planetary stewardship. He proposes we use the simpler, but perhaps more painful objective of sufficiency. Dedecker argues that pursuing greener, more efficient methods and technologies is, more often than not, a fool's errand. He maintains that the human appetite for comfort, growth, and acquisition tends to turn efficiencies into increased consumption, and that the only way to truly fight climate change is for all of us to recognize that enough is, well, enough. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Chris Dedecker. He is the creator and author of Low Tech Magazine. Chris, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, good evening.
Coming to us live from outside of Barcelona, Spain, right?
Yes.
So you just recently penned a piece for Low Tech Magazine, which people can find on lowtechmagazine.com. It's an excellent blog and online magazine that you founded. It's entitled Bedazzled by Energy Efficiency. And in the article, you essentially write that sufficiency is what we need more than efficiency. Why don't you first kind of define efficiency versus sufficiency within the rubric of the environmental movement, if you can?
Well, efficiency is like a cornerstone of environmental policy. And it actually means that we do more things with the same energy input. So you keep the energy use constant, but you get more out of it. Or you get the same output, but you put a bit less energy into it. So it's a relative measurement. And in that sense, it's not a guarantee for reducing energy demand, while energy sufficiency really aims to lower absolute amounts of energy use or oil imports, for instance.
And what is the problem with the model of trying to improve efficiency? We're not just talking about homes being more insulated, or we're not talking about devices necessarily using less energy. There's kind of a whiplash effect, isn't there, in your estimation?
Yeah, so for instance, if you talk about the heating of homes and say you go insulate your house, what we see is that after such a retrofit, it's that indoor temperatures rise. So people, instead of saving, say, 60% of energy, they save maybe 20%, and the rest is converted into extra comfort. Another example is lighting. So we have now the LED lights that are more energy efficient. It's like six times more, less energy for the same amount of light you get. But then you see that the result is not six times less energy use, but it's close to six times more light. So because energy lighting use becomes cheaper, we start using lights in more places. We leave it on for longer. That's what they call the rebound effect.
So that's called Javan's paradox. Why don't you take a step back and explain who Javan is and what his theory was?
So he was an economist, and he saw that when the steel making process became much more efficient by the use of new technology, I forgot the exact number, but say it became 10 times more energy efficient, then you would expect that steel industry starts using 10 times less energy, but the result was the opposite. So because steel production became much more affordable, we found many new applications to use steel, and the result was much more energy use instead of less energy use. And you see a similar thing, a very good example is also the computers. So computers since the 1950s have become more and more efficient, and really there's a lot of progress there in the efficiency of microchips. But it's not that computers, all computers together, don't use less electricity than they did in the 1950s. On the contrary, we have much more computers now, and they're everywhere. They're in our pockets, they are on our desks, they're in devices. And why is that? Because they became much more energy efficient, which allows many new opportunities and applications of the technology. Yeah, so energy efficiency is actually fueling the economic growth, and it brings us more technology, new technology, more comfort, faster cars, more luxurious cars. But by itself, it does not bring any energy savings. So these days, people, when they talk about energy efficiency, they assume that it will result in energy savings, but that's hardly ever the case.
So it's just a cheap sugar rush for our consciences, isn't it?
Yes, definitely. So if you look at it, it's quite remarkable that everybody believes in energy efficiency. It's the big corporations, the politicians, the environmental organizations, everybody agrees about that. And that's because, of course, it's just business as usual, basically. So that's why nobody is really offended by energy efficiency, because it's actually how life goes now. We get more efficient technology, that new efficient technology brings new products, we buy the new products, and we feel that we are progressing. But it's not a solution to, if you agree we should reduce energy use, then efficiency by itself is not going to do it.
Yes, in a vacuum, it's really not a solution. Just some more examples that came to mind while you were speaking. I was thinking of, so when Henry Ford created a more automated system for building automobiles, it seemed like a much more efficient way to build cars. And the result was not energy savings in terms of building cars. It was a lot more cars, and now we see how many cars are on the road, and that's far from an efficient model. Similarly, you look at things like LED lighting, which I know the lighting industry has been very excited about over the last decade or so, because these lights are more powerful and use less energy. But then you see LED lighting billboards, and it results in more lights, not in less energy use, right?
Yes, the digital billboards are a great example, because they're basically like giant television screens standing outside, and they're made of energy efficient components, but of course they use enormous amount of energy. Yeah, it's also a new application of a technology, so it doesn't, it's just extra energy use.
The fire escape is folded like the cradle of an arm. Our dread so deep, we've learned to keep it near without alarm. But every fear is like a prayer, you learn to shout out loud. From your lips to God's ear, turns the face of every crowd. And now here comes everybody, a closet renegade, a weary, hungry soldier from the children's lost crusade. Here comes the restitution we'd all but given up. We're content believing that love will be enough.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Chris Dedecker. He is the founder of Low Tech Magazine, and his latest piece is Bedazzled by Energy Efficiency. So, Chris, you were just talking about politicians and other environmentalists being very much on the same page in terms of praying at the altar, shall we say, of energy efficiency. Why don't you apply this to our energy grids around the globe, if you can? We're transitioning to much cleaner solutions, but you don't necessarily see that as ultimately solving the problem, do you?
No, because of course you have the supply side and you have the demand side. And it's true that we are making the supply side more sustainable. We are using more renewable energy. But at the same time, the demand for energy keeps going up.
Maybe you can apply this to avoided energy and define that as well.
So what you see with renewables, that the share of renewables in the total energy mix is increasing. But total demand for energy is increasing even faster. So the use of fossil fuels keeps growing. And although the share of renewables also grows, it doesn't grow as fast. And so how can you then prove that renewables bring any advantage? And that's done by avoided emissions. So the reasoning is that we would have used even more fossil fuels if we would not have installed all these wind turbines and solar panels. And that's a very friendly way to say, like, we're not getting anywhere, we're not able to reduce energy demand, but it could have been even worse. That's basically what avoided emissions means. And you see the same with in the energy efficiency policy. The avoided energy is a conceptual thing, it's an abstract thing. It's like we look at an appliance, for instance, computers. We imagine they don't get more energy efficient from now, and we extrapolate their energy use 30 years in the future. And then we calculate how much energy we saved by making them more efficient. But that's a very, it has not much to do with reality, because the only secure outcome you have is that energy use will keep growing. And that's actually already embedded in the definition of energy efficiency when they say, okay, we will use so much energy in 2030 and we will use a bit less. We will use less than that because of energy efficiency. I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear here.
I think I understand. One of the parallels you make in your piece is when policymakers or agencies are creating standards for, let's say, clothes dryers, for electric-powered washer and dryers. They just compare the old model and then say, yes, we've gotten 20% more efficient, but they don't put clotheslines into the calculus. Is that what you're trying to get at?
Yeah, so hey, there's two ways to look at, say, why energy efficiency is problematic. And most people say it's the rebound effects. You get, like, because energy gets more, technology gets more efficient, there's more use of it. But there's actually a deeper issue, and that's the fact that you can only make a energy efficiency calculation if you compare things that are similar. So if you, like you say, if you would compare the energy efficiency of a clothesline with the energy efficiency of a tumble dryer, yeah, that's impossible, because the service is not the same. So what is the most energy efficient? You cannot calculate that. The concept, the abstraction of energy efficiency doesn't allow it.
And perhaps our scientific models don't necessarily feed into this. I was thinking when I read your clothesline analogy, I was thinking of the pharmaceutical industry in the United States, how when a new generation of pharmaceuticals come out, they are tested against the previous generation instead of a placebo. So, for example, any drug should be tested against a baseline placebo and to see how effective that drug is in a vacuum. Instead, we just say, oh, this drug works 20% better than that other drug. And that's where we end up taking more drugs. But let's get back to the quote-unquote clean energy solutions. I mean, when we're talking about solar power, that's just so much cleaner than a coal plant. Why can't we look at that as a efficient use of our technology?
Well, it's a good question because you say like solar power is cleaner than fossil fuels, and that's exactly the right way to say it. It's cleaner, but it's not clean because you still need fossil fuels to produce the solar panel. And if you're not using fossil fuels, you're going to need to build another solar plant to build the solar plant. So there's always a embodied in the solar panel, there is a certain amount of fossil fuels, and more even if you want to store it for use on a later moment in batteries. This whole infrastructure also requires energy. So it's not, switching to renewables is not an excuse to then use whatever energy that we like, because it's more efficient. Solar panels are in fact a more efficient way to use fossil fuels, and that's it's not that they are something completely different. What is completely different, for instance, is say biomass that grows in the sunshine and you just cut it down and you burn it. There you don't need to invest fossil fuels, at least if you do everything by hand. But so this whole idea that once you have installed renewable power plants, we can now use as much energy as we would like, that's not really true.
But what about things that have already kind of reached mass acceptance? For example, I'm thinking in China, their mass transportation system. Let's say their buses are already running at full capacity, and now they're transitioning their fleet to electric vehicles. Why wouldn't that be a net positive in terms of saving fossil fuel consumption?
Well, in that case, you're gonna it operates on many different levels, these rebound effects, because say you're gonna make all the buses more energy efficient, then the country as a whole has gonna have more energy available that can be put into other things. So you can it's the classical example of someone who insulates their house and then saves money, and then uses that money to take a plane trip to the other side of the world to celebrate its new insulation. So it's hard to kind of stop that. So you can make something, if you look at individual technology, it can become more energy efficient and save energy, but you're also causing things outside that technology, outside the borders of this individual technology or device or sector even.
So in China, how would they be using that energy elsewhere that they would have applied to their mass transit vehicles otherwise?
They could provide more electricity or energy to the population, lower energy prices, to which would make sense for the economy. If you make sure that people can have use more energy, you will see your economy grow, of course.
When we put energy efficiency hand in hand with growth, we're kind of fooling ourselves, is the underlying thesis. Is that fair to say?
I would say actually they're just the same thing. Energy efficiency is economic growth, and the other way around.
Well, it wasn't necessarily 100 years ago, but that's where we are today, right?
Yeah, of course, because what's changed is the type of fuels that we use. Before, we were very much limited to what the environment produced in terms of solar power, in terms of wind power, water power. So you had a human population that also, yeah, in quantity, but also in their technology, stayed within certain limits because it was simply impossible to escape from that. A while ago, we found a very abundant source of energy. And then, of course, you can grow a lot for a certain period, of course. This cannot go on forever, that's for sure.
Yeah.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to Chris Dedecker. He is the founder of Low Tech Magazine. So Chris, let's turn to sufficiency, because the efficiency model seems rather hopeless under what you've laid out. Do you think we're able to kind of flip on a dime and start focusing on reducing services in general and not just try to make the services that we've fallen in love with more efficient?
Yeah, if we will manage, I don't know. But there are ways to do it. And it's not that energy efficiency is... one solution would be to make everything less energy efficient. That's the logical outcome of what I was telling before. And that would be one political strategy. So, for instance, what I said before, if you would mandate energy inefficient heating systems, yeah, then people cannot heat their houses to the same standards that they're gotten used to now. But there is a more elegant solution, and that's to combine sufficiency with sufficiency. So efficiency can be part of the solution, and it's not that it's a bad thing. The problem is that it doesn't work by itself. It should be complemented by a sufficiency approach. And then there's a lot of things possible. For instance, when you talk about cars, you could make cars much lighter. You could make them much smaller with less electronics inside. And then you have an energy efficient engine in this little car. Yeah, then the result is really a vehicle, personal motorized transportation that maybe uses as much as a computer. So somehow the idea of efficiency, of making everything efficient, should go together with some concept of limits. So that, for instance, with light, you say, okay, the lights are getting more and more efficient, so we can have more and more and more lights. But if we would somehow keep the amount of lighting the same, and in the meanwhile we continue making lighting more energy efficient, then you see the energy go down. Then we can actually reduce energy use.
So what do we say to people in developed countries who already are in certain habits, and what do we say to people in developing nations who are just starting to fall into these habits? How does this turn into good policy, Chris?
Yeah, so first, people in developed countries. That, of course, the big problem, the big challenge of a sufficiency policy is that people are, like you say, they are used to certain kinds of certain ways of life. And actually, the fact is, the longer we wait, the harder it will become. Because now, you say, like, if you try to, say, take people's tumble dryers away, you would have a lot of protest. If you would have done that 40 years ago, nobody would have cared because nobody had them. So every time, every year, it becomes more difficult to have a sufficiency approach, because people indeed get used to more energy intensive ways of life, and it's always hard to go back. So that's a problem, and that's a big challenge. And a sufficiency policy, while it's really what we need, it's very difficult, it's controversial, it's could even be considered authoritarian. So it's a big challenge of how we're gonna do that. What concerns the... So one way, for instance, to do it in developed countries, you said that not everybody has a space for a clothesline, for instance, and that's true. And that's actually what politicians can do something about that. For instance, here in Spain, every apartment has a special room to hang the clothes. So it's already in the infrastructure. Nobody here has a tumble dryer. I don't even think they know what it is, because every house, every apartment has a special infrastructure for drying the clothes. So that's a way to... yeah, you can say people stop using tumble dryers or outlaw the tumble dryers, but I think it's a better idea to, as a government, for instance, to mandate that new buildings should have spaces for clotheslines.
But you have a society in Spain which is used to that. What if we started having that mandated in the US? People would freak out.
Well, of course, the US is a particularly difficult country, as nowhere else in the world, except for Saudi Arabia, I think, do people use so much energy.
And in Saudi Arabia, that's not most people, right?
Yeah, there it's also not really distributed very well. But yeah, the US is, well, I think already Europe is difficult, because of course here I also talk to people, and people are not willing to give up even the smallest things or make the smallest change. So then, yeah, well, in the US it's difficult, yeah.
And isn't that the problem with a democracy? I mean, the kid who's running for school president who promises no homework and extra long recesses, he's going to get, or he or she is going to get elected to be the school president. I mean, if you look at who our president is, he was promising some terrible things to a lot of people, but to those people, that was appealing. You know, build a wall and Mexico will pay for it. He'll just say whatever he wants. So people don't want to hear, hey, we got to buckle down, we got to stop using so much hot water. That's just not an appealing message. So how does a politician get elected under that kind of a strategy, if we're going to actually switch to a sufficiency model, Chris?
Well, I think we need actually a kind of Donald Trump that would have, instead of being so obsessed by, I don't know, immigration and stuff, he would be obsessed by the environment. Then we could maybe get somewhere. But if you see like a country as China, which is obviously not a democracy, of course, it's much easier to do these things. If one day the dictatorship of China decides that we need a sufficiency nation, then they can do it in maybe 1 year. And that's, of course, that's problem of democracy. But considering the risks of a dictatorship model, I think there's also other ways. And I think what we need is a politician that, or politicians that are not afraid to tell people that they cannot have everything. And then I guess that takes someone with charisma, someone that people like, and that kind of tries to tell people, like, listen, we cannot go further like this. Maybe we should try to change. And I know it's very difficult, but I don't consider it impossible.
Well, it's an important piece. We'll link to it on Sea Change Radio. It's entitled Bedazzled by Energy Efficiency. Chris Dedecker is the founder of Low Tech Magazine. Chris, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Leroy Hudson, Joe Henry, and The Meters.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.